You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Shach Steinberg doubles as an education reporter and the editor of a blog about college admissions process at the New York Times. It's called The Choice. This year has been among the most competitive for college applicants, and the sudden change in the economy has made the process even more treacherous. And I'm delighted to welcome Shach Steinberg back to the show. I don't know why I said it was treacherous, and then I said I'm delighted to welcome you back, but I guess I want to have things cleared up. Since you started writing the blog, have you been inundated with invitations to cocktail parties by desperate parents?
You know, one of the things that's been really wonderful about doing the blog is that we have this, for a really nice slice of our readership, this is really hitting home, particularly parents of juniors and seniors. And rather than sort of writing these crazy notes to us saying, help us, they've been supplying tremendous amounts of advice to the young people who we hope were in our readership. I mean, there's a wealth of experience there. And for the most part, our readers have delivered it in a very calm, measured, thoughtful way.
Well, you're lucky you're blogging to the Times readership, because I have read any number of blogs and been amazed by just how high level the comments are.
The most fun of it, we picked six seniors. I mean, it was hard to pick six that were representative of various parts of this process. Six high school seniors, and we asked them to blog for the month of April about the decisions they were going to face. Each had heard from various schools. Each was going to have a decision. Almost all of them, finances were going to help with that decision. And they would go up with a post that said, you know, I got accepted to a free ride at UConn, but I kind of am tempted by NYU, but it would mean such a financial sacrifice for my family. And then our readers would pour out, you know, 75 comments over the course of a lunch telling these kids what they thought they should do.
Isn't the situation complicated by the fact that demographically the number of applicants in the last 2 years has been larger than any time in history?
It's certainly, you've got that bubble that's coming in.
This is like the ultimate baby boom, which without being called a baby boom?
But it's even worse than that, because we as a society, or certainly as a segment of society, have decided that there are only 4 dozen or so colleges in this country. And in fact, there are 2,000 four-year colleges in this country. But, you know, try telling that to a kid at Stuyvesant or at Scarsdale High School. So as a result, you've got this demographic bulge, and then you've got all these people flocking to these schools because everybody's flocking to these schools.
And they have to make the decision now, because May is the month, isn't it?
May 1st is when most of the deposits are due. Now, you can hedge your bets, particularly this year. Maybe you put down a few $100 deposit at a school and wait to see if you come off the waiting list. This year, I think more than any other, because kids' finances are so dicey, the colleges themselves really don't know who they're going to get.
Hasn't the New York Times been fanning the flames for this crisis? Last year, it looked like every month there was an article about how it was the worst year ever and the largest group of kids applying to college, and many of them applying to multiple safety schools. And now we're hearing that this year is even worse.
And it happens to be true, but also I don't think you can blame the messenger here. I mean, we're trying to capture it. In the course of this blog, as well as the book I did a few years ago, The Gatekeepers, I tried at least to demystify this process.
Well, and The Gatekeepers was about Wesleyan.
Yeah.
Is Wesleyan changing? Would it be a different book if you were writing it now?
I think the process is nearly identical. The process, the year that I was there, they had 10 applicants for each seat in the freshman class. And the process they used was pretty much the same process that was used at a place like Harvard or Dartmouth or MIT or Stanford. The difference now is there's just more of them, if that's possible. But I really, you know, to your point about the Times sort of reporting about this as if it were the Yankees, I think information serves to demystify, and that at least you feel like reading this blog or reading our coverage, at least you know what's going on.
But is this a crisis period?
Of course not. I mean, everybody will get in somewhere terrific. I mean, you may not get into your first, second, third, or fourth choice. But again, you know, if there's 2,000 four-year colleges in this country, everybody will get in somewhere terrific.
Well, the problem is not getting in. In fact, many schools are concerned that they're not getting enough applicants.
Yeah. So
we have this odd situation where the schools are concerned about losing admissions, and at the same time, students are concerned about not getting into schools. It's because of money, isn't
it? Yeah, the crisis is a financial one, and there is this increasingly large swath of the middle class that's not going to get the financial aid, not even close to what they need.
And is another reason that we're seeing so many applicants that students are applying to more schools than they did in the past? In the past, somebody might apply to four or five schools. Now it seems like they're applying to dozens.
Yeah, and you might apply to a dozen. And
it's expensive.
And it's in part because it's so easy, setting aside the cost. The common application, which didn't really exist when I was applying in the mid-'80s, makes it so easy to push a button, and then you've applied to a dozen schools.
My guest is Jacques Steinberg of The New York Times. By the way, we invite your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Or our version, I guess, of blogging. I'll try to integrate as many as we get into the course of this conversation. Is this college mania something that's national, or is this mostly an East Coast obsession?
It's most certainly national. A few years ago, an editor at the New York Times had the idea to sort of test this very question. And we wanted to look at the notion of the pressure on sixth graders. And so he said to a couple of us who were education writers, as you go around the country, wherever you're going on an education story, stay for an extra half day and interview a dozen sixth graders wherever you are. And one of the places I went was Nogales, Arizona, right on the Mexican border. And I saw with my own eyes when I walked in that these kids were surfing the website of Harvard in the sixth grade. And I saw the equivalent at the Las Vegas schools where I went to next. So the internet has been the great equalizer here.
But even before the sixth grade, we have people in New York, and maybe it's happening in Nogales as well, who are pretty much ready to commit crimes to get their kids into the right preschool. And it's obvious that if you get into the right nursery or the right high school, it really will affect your possibilities of getting into the college you want to go to.
Well, that's what they think, of course.
Is this just something parents are obsessed by, not the kids?
I think the idea of linking nursery school to where you're going to get into college is a bit much. But I agree with you that attitude exists far beyond the five boroughs.
In March, you wrote an article in the Times about how the economy was affecting the college process, and it became the newspaper's most emailed article. How badly have colleges been affected?
I think that, first of all, I think that the article you're referring to, I think, was by my colleague, Kate Zernike. And one of the things that Kate found was that certain colleges, certain colleges who considered themselves need blind, that they would take you regardless of your ability to play, were becoming more need aware. That if they looked at the application, even keeping your financial aid application separate, if there even was a financial aid application, judging by what your parents did and what their level of education was, it looked pretty good to them that you might be somebody who could pay full freight, which in sort of a holistic process might elevate you to the top of the pile.
So let me understand this. They're claiming to still be needs blind, but then they're looking at your zip code and saying, oh, this person's coming from a more affluent neighborhood, or they are perhaps checking out where your parents went to school?
Yeah, I don't want to say that that's happening everywhere where these colleges are need blind. I mean, the Ivies, for example, still have tremendous endowments.
And Harvard would probably not suffer no matter what.
I don't think so. And even though their endowment is down like everybody else's. But there are certain colleges that are need blind that maybe they can't quite afford to be after the last couple of years, where you know, you sort of do it with a wink. Their process remains the same, but all that has to happen is that when that committee is meeting to decide who's in and who's out, someone can say, and remind me what mom and dad do again, mm-hmm. and suddenly you're need aware.
So this means that poor people are going to have a harder time getting into good schools.
I don't think it's quite as abrupt a change as that. I think at certain schools, it could have more of an impact on the middle class, where there's not going to be that ability to pay. The poor kids are still there's a tremendous amount of resources out there for them. But that definition of kid who can't afford to get an education at one of these places grows every year, and the financial aid doesn't necessarily grow at the same rate.
So a lower middle class kid better either have a lot of athletic ability or fit into some diversity category?
Certainly, these colleges, we tend to think of them as talent scouts, and they most certainly are that. But they really see themselves as social engineers. They're trying to build these utopian communities. And in these communities, you obviously need a second baseman and a quarterback, and you need a first violinist. But mercifully, you need journalists, too, and you need poets. And sometimes a bang-up job on your high school newspaper can be the equivalent of being a quarterback at the right place.
Some people feel that the U.S. News and World Report ranking system is to blame. How important is it for a college to rise in the U.S. News rankings?
We as parents are consumed by it. I mean, I as somebody who's looked at those rankings know that you shouldn't really put a lot of stock in them, and yet we find them irresistible, and I get all bummed out when Dartmouth, my alma mater, drops by 3 ranks, even though I know it doesn't mean anything. One of the things that surprised me in this process is how much the colleges pay attention to it, the alumni, the boards of trustees, and they follow these as closely as we do, and it really can make a difference to them in terms of their number of applicants when they rise, and at times if they really plunge. And sometimes the reasons for either going up or down are really sort of hard to divine as an outsider.
Well, as a caller points out that although it's claimed that it doesn't matter where you went to school, employers do typically look for people who went to the top-ranked schools. And so
I'd be careful about generalizing about that. I mean, certainly that was the case at a place like the New York Times a few decades ago. I don't see it as much anymore. It remains a way to get in certain places, particularly to get that interview. It's hardly the only way, and I would argue that it's probably less true. But to say that it doesn't matter at all is probably disingenuous.
And networking also plays a role later in life. If you went to a school like I went to Brooklyn College, I don't know anybody. I don't remember any of the people I went to school with because I didn't live at the school. I just simply saw a lot of different people in my different classes.
Yeah, increasingly, I mean, my kids are 8 and 10 when my daughter is ready to apply in 7 years. Am I going to be able to justify that networking component be enough to justify that huge difference in tuition between my alma mater and SUNY Binghamton? Obviously, that's not the only thing you get. You get many other things. But can we really rationalize this?
Can't the colleges actually torture the numbers to make themselves look more selective for the U.S. News rankings?
There's no question that some of the schools do torture themselves to put themselves in a better light. A few years ago, the Wall Street Journal wrote a story about Franklin and Marshall, a small liberal arts college in Pennsylvania. And what Franklin and Marshall was doing was rejecting some of the most qualified kids in their pool because they knew they weren't going to come. And why would they do this? Because one of the things that U.S. News measured at that time was yield. How many people did you offer admission to who then turned around and accepted your admission? Why should we take that kid with the near-perfect SAT score if he's never going to come? And that's, depending on how you look at it, kind of sad.
I want to talk about SATs after we take a little break. My guest is Jacques Steinberg, who is an education reporter and the editor of a blog called The Choice about the college admissions process. It's at the New York Times. And a reminder that we are also inviting your comments on our show page. You can also call in at 212-433-9692 and tell one of my producers what your concerns are. We'll be back with all of that right after this. Later on in the show, film critic David Thompson talks about growing up in post-war London, and then the former head of the a former FDA commissioner explains how Americans are being conditioned to overeat. This Wednesday in WNYC's Green Space, you can hear a modern reimagining of the H.G. Wells classic, The Invisible Man, starring Peter Garrity, with music performed live by Michael Reisman, director of the Philip Glass Ensemble. Purchase tickets now at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. That's green with an E at the end. This is WNYC and wnyc.org. We're back with Jacques Steinberg, who blogs at the New York Times, a blog called The Choice, and also is an education reporter, appears regularly in the newspaper. And we're talking about college admissions this year, which are going through something of a crisis. Rita in New York City left a question on our show page. She asks, is there any recourse for a graduating senior whose parents will not help financially at all under any circumstances to attend a college to which the student was accepted and even got a partial scholarship?
I think one of the things about this process is that there is a means of appeal. On or around April 1st, a lot of kids got their decisions as well as their financial aid packages. And every school is different. But certainly there's no reason not to go back to a school and have this information provided to the school. They will come up on an offer at times, particularly if it's made clear to them that a competing institution has also offered more.
So that's it. You actually have to do the same thing as you do when you go looking for a job. Well, I've been offered such and such by this other company. Can you match that offer?
It can happen. It depends. If you go back to our analogy about the social engineering in this community they're creating, if they want you bad enough, they may be able to sort of tweak their definition of what your need is. But again, it comes back to that question of do they want you or do they need you? And can you make a persuasive enough argument? They will tell you that they don't negotiate. But I've certainly heard stories of a kid going into Yale with Harvard's letter and saying, can you match it? Can you beat it?
A legacy still a sure thing?
A legacy is never a sure thing, but if your parent or sibling went to the institution or is currently going to the institution in a case of a sibling, whether it's a Harvard or a Dartmouth or a Wesleyan or a Stanford, you've probably doubled your chances of admission. But in the case of a place like Wesleyan, that means that probably half the legacies are admitted, but it also means that half are rejected.
Hasn't the U.S. News' yield calculation made the early decision application much more critical to the college?
Sure. I mean, if you're looking for yield, that formula of what percentage of kids did you offer admission to who turned around and then it accepted you as an institution, that's guaranteed yield. In the case of a place like Wesleyan or Dartmouth, you have guaranteed as an applicant, if you take me early, I will attend. I should say, though, that U.S. News, in response to some of the criticism over that calculation, has sort of de-emphasized that to a certain extent in its formula, or at least it says it does. On the other hand, the colleges, some of these colleges, you know, can't afford to take a chance that a kid might not be around in the spring. And so you see somebody in your early pool. You think there's a good chance that Harvard might take that kid. You grab that kid. It's a binding decision.
When I was applying to colleges, the SATs and I don't even remember if they were GPAs, were all voluntary, and not every school required them. What's the situation today?
Certainly, if we come back to that definition of, you know, there are 2,000 four-year colleges in this country, there's about 48 or so, four dozen or so, that turn away more kids than they accept, which is a really small number in the scheme of things. But if we're talking about that universe of 48 or so, most of those schools are going to require the SAT or the ACT. But a growing number of schools, as chronicled by an organization in Boston called fairtest.org, are going SAT optional. And increasingly, these are schools that are among that highly selective group. Bowdoin, Bates, schools like this that are no longer requiring it. And then there is the second question of, a school requires the SAT, but what does that mean? A school like Wesleyan, a school like Harvard, a school like Dartmouth, a school like Dartmouth does not have a cutoff. The SAT is one piece of information among many that they are considering.
So how important are the SAT scores? Do highly selective schools have a benchmark? A candidate not including athletes or minorities has to have a minimal score to be even looked at?
Obviously, the SATs are important at the schools that require them. But the notion of these exams being standardized, of these results being standardized, is a false one. The fact is that every kid's score is going to be looked at in context. And for example, a white applicant of means who is applying to one of these highly selective four dozen or so, a school like Wesleyan, for example, is going to be expected. The hope is going to be that they got a 1,400 on those traditional first two parts of the SAT, the math and the verbal.
So you have to do well in both. You can't just do very well in the verbal, but not – some people are just so bad at math.
They would like you to do well at both. But remember, it's not a cutoff. And what else do you bring to the conversation? So I would hate for the mother of a kid in your listening audience who is white and of means, whose kid did not get that score, to think, oh my God, tear up the application to Middlebury. He's not going to get in next year. But it's important for that applicant to think, what else do I bring to this community that they're trying to create that they might want? And the fact is, there are a number of things that they might want. It's your responsibility, though, and that of your guidance counselor to bring that to the attention of the admissions committee. I want to make one other point. Another example, we haven't talked at all about affirmative action. These institutions practice affirmative action. It is extremely important to their educational mission, as they've defined it, to have diversity in their class in the broadest sense of the word diversity. And one thing certainly is racial or ethnic diversity. One of the places where this is brought to bear is the SAT. If you are an applicant of color, and particularly an applicant of color who is not of means, they might be willing to accept an SAT score of several hundred points lower. Again, it's not done on a hard and fast scale. It's a part of the process that many people will tell you is unfair. And the fact is that any college that is being honest will say, how could you possibly make this fair?
Well, but it's unfair in another way, because you can be tutored to get better SAT scores, which would mean that wealthier kids have an advantage on that level.
And one of the things that they try to do when they look at that kid of means and they expect a score perhaps of 200 points more than that kid who is not of means is to say, the odds are probably pretty good that you availed yourself of a prep course. And there is some evidence that the prep course will boost your score.
My guest is Jacques Steinberg of the New York Times. He is not only writing regularly for the newspaper, but also the editor of a blog about the college admissions process called The Choice. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You were talking about some of the other things. Your grade point average would be a major consideration, other things you did at school. But what does that mean? Is a student better off being the valedictorian of a mediocre neighborhood high school or in the bottom quarter of the graduating class at Stuyvesant? And then extending that, what about AP classes? Are students better off protecting their GPA with easy classes or struggling through the more demanding AP classes and not always getting A's?
This is the part of the process where you can truly make yourself nuts, and many people have and will. And the fact is, having sat in, as I did, on the year that I spent watching the admissions committee at Wesleyan, which is a fairly typical in its approach, it is impossible for us as outsiders to divine the formula that would incorporate all of the things that you just described. In fact, I would argue that it is impossible to do that. You know, whether you're the top kid at the mediocre high school or in the bottom quarter of the Stuyvesant, it can be tricky to try to outsmart that process. And yes, in the reality of this process, there are only going to be so much room for so many kids from Stuyvesant in the name of diversity, in the broadest sense of the word diversity, at a place like Wesleyan. They could certainly make up the entire Wesleyan class with graduates of Stuyvesant, but that's not what they're looking for. So that might throw the process in the direction of that kid who was the valedictorian at the more mediocre high school. But did that kid at the more mediocre high school get a better education? And is that what it's all about? And I think, as outsiders, I think the best advice you can give is to sort of, as a student, as parents, encourage your kids to sort of get the most out of this process and let the chips fall where they may. I mean, do it for the right reasons. Don't take up lacrosse because you think that's what the admissions committee at Williams is going to want in 8 years. It can truly make you crazy.
A listener in New Jersey left a comment on a show page saying, be careful about those freshman grants. I've heard a few stories of aid being substantially reduced for subsequent years on the assumption that the student will take on more debt to stay than they might have initially.
There's certainly a lot of these packages are the package for the freshman year, and no promise or guarantee is made for subsequent years. It can happen. Whether it happens as sort of systematic process, I think it depends on the institution. But there's certainly that nothing that stops you as a parent or student from exploring this very question with the institution that you're interested in attending, and maybe even getting something in writing if that's possible.
Pete in Massapequa left a comment on our show page. One of the things you and your guest might be missing is that there really aren't that many choices for applicants when you really get down to picking and choosing.
It depends what your definition of choice is. It's a broad generalization to point out that there are several thousand four-year colleges in this country. But I think that in and of itself constitutes choice. If you are in that increasingly large middle class, the options for direct aid and even for loans to a certain extent, yes, that is going to limit your choices. But it's still, there are plenty of colleges that might well want you and might be willing to give money to you. The question is, in that case, do you want them?
Stephanie in Colorado left a comment on our show page. She says, I feel like the colleges deserve to be having trouble with enrollment. The rates they have been charging are outrageous, and the money is not going to the professors. I remember reading a report about a decade ago stating that rates were skyrocketing not because of the school's budget needs, but simply because they decided to charge whatever the market would allow. Where's all that money going to? The top executives?
I mean, it's going lots of places. Certainly in the past year, a number of top colleges have at least paid lip service to examining these very choices. Do we really need the dorm that has to be furnished like the Waldorf Astoria? Do we really need to be paying certain people what we're paying them? And there are furloughs going on at these institutions. There are pay freezes. It has forced them to get religion in terms of what they charge. But again, when you get all these applications to Harvard, even this year, in the midst of the recession, an all-time high in terms of the number of applicants to almost all the Ivies. If I'm one of these institutions, we're not always making it such a persuasive that they should change their ways.
Well, what Stephanie wrote sounds to me as being similar to what people are saying about people on Wall Street. And we have heard about some college presidents making $1 million or more.
Yeah,
are they worth it? Obviously, they're being paid that because they can go out and get money from people. But have some of those people really been worth it?
I think that question is being asked now at the upper level of some of these institutions. And in this economic downturn, can you rationalize that some of these presidents are worth the salaries they're getting, that the professors are worth it? But it sure has been scary for a lot of these colleges, what is happening now. And they're all sort of holding their breath. How many of the kids they accepted are going to accept them? They're really wondering.
Mary from Park Slope asks, is it still true that the Ivy League colleges keep a quota on women because there are far more highly qualified female than male students applying?
It's a complicated question, and I think they would dispute the use of the word quota, but it doesn't mean that they don't pay attention to it and that they are trying to strike something of a balance. And so that may not have been the case when I applied in the mid-'80s, but it might be more so now.
Your blog said that support staff has doubled in the past few years at colleges. So that has also added. Why do they need all that extra support staff?
I think they're finding that maybe they don't. And they were, at a point where, as you say, they seemed to be able to set these prices and the market would bear them. They can't continue to do business as usual. And so a place like Dartmouth, for the first time since I went there, had furloughs this year.
So what advice would you give to a parent or a kid. Is the advice the same to either?
I think so. I mean, it's the best advice you can give, you know, can't help but sound Pollyannish. But it happens to be true, which is that you need to take a deep breath and you need to relax. Whether it's the question of where you want to go and whether they'll have you, or whether you can afford to go where you want to go, these things can be worked out. And certainly all of this has gone in the direction of making state schools more attractive and more competitive.
And I'm sure community colleges for
community
some kids
colleges
as well.
And it really does work out. Not maybe the way you thought it would or your child thought it would, not maybe the way you dreamed for years that it would, but the process does in the end seem to work.
And John in Sunset Park wonders whether these issues also apply to graduate schools.
Similarly, certainly in terms of graduate school, you have some kids who are taking the attitude, particularly in a state like California, a couple of years of community college, then go into the Cal State or the US or the UC system, and then really save up for grad school, which and then, you know, puts pressure on some of the elite grad schools.
Just one more question. Allison asks, what are some of the other good up-and-coming universities?
I'm going to take something of a cop-out and refer you to a book, which I really love, called Colleges That Change Lives. It's by a gentleman named Lauren Pope, who died last fall at the age of 90 or close to it. And these are 50 or so colleges that you probably haven't heard of. And the book makes the argument that they produce a terrific education.
And we've always seen that. Carl Gerassi, who was a major biologist that gave us the birth control pill formula. He was an immigrant here. He was sent to a very small school which had a brilliant faculty and very few students, and he said he got the kind of attention he never would have gotten if he had gone to one of the more prestigious schools.
Yeah, that's what this book, Colleges That Change Lives, does. But do bear in mind that some of these schools are really hurting in terms of their finances.
And I suspect that no matter what you say, when people see that you went to Joe Schmo School and did well, that they just do not take it as seriously as if you did well at Yale or Harvard.
I'd like to think the world is increasingly different than that, but it's complicated.
Jacques Steinberg's blog is called The Choice, and he also doubles as an education reporter at The New York Times. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Up next, film critic David Thompson discusses what life was like in London after World War II and how that bleak landscape shaped his childhood. And we invite you to hear a modern reimagining of the H.G. Wells classic, The Invisible Man, starring Peter Garrity, with music performed live by Michael Riesman, director of the Philip Glass Ensemble. It's this Wednesday in WNYC's Green Space. Purchase tickets now at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.